So the first Truma opens with the notion that God wants donations. And he wants us to build a Mishkan, and then from there we go on to talk about the concept of building the Ark. And after the Ark we talk about its cover, keep the lid on, and then afterwards we talk about the golden table. Which brings us to the third reading that opens with the narrative of the menorah. Chapter 25, verse 31, V'yasisa menoras zohov toher. You should make a menorah, a candelabra, of pure as gold. Miksha, as we'll soon see what this means. Te'ase ha-menorah, the menorah should be made in a manner of miksha. Yerecha v'kono, its shaft, its branches. Gvi'eha kafteireha ufrocheha, its goblets, its spheres or knobs, and its flowers. Mimena yihyu, all of them should be from it. In other words, as we soon see in Rashi, they should not be added on superficially. Let us take a look in Rashi first, and then we'll see what some of the other mefarshim say. Pasuk lamed aleph, miksha te'ase hamenoida. The menoida should be made in a manner of miksha. Rashi says, first and foremost, that means that the menorah should not be made of individual pieces. And then solder together. Do not make the branches and the lamps as individual pieces. Then after, they would be attached, as is the manner of people who are involved with metalwork. So goldsmiths. So in the smithy kind of work or profession, for the most part, things are made piecemeal. Things are assembled. And things are soldered together. The vast majority of artifacts that you will see made of metal are made in that fashion. And here, the Torah very clearly tells us that that's not the way the menorah should be made. Rather, miksha teyasa, which means Elo kulo bo michaticha achas. The entirety of the menorah, which is very, very detail-oriented, must come from a single ingot of gold, one block of gold. Umakish bikurnos. And so you would sculpt it with a hammer, which is kind of a goldsmithy hammer, and you're going to sculpt and carve out the menorah to make all of its ornate details. V'choytech b'chli ha'umanis, you'll be able to cut out the shape of the menorah with the sculpting tools. U'mafrid ha'konim eilech v'eilech, you would separate the branches from one another. So the branches would initially start out being one ingot of gold, one block, and you slowly hammer out and you slowly form the different branches of the menorah. That's the meaning of miksha. So the first expression that Rashi explains to us is not the verbiage, but what does it mean? Practically speaking, what does God want from us? How did he want us to make this menorah? And the answer is miksha. Now Rashi goes back to the actual verbiage, and he says, the word miksha, what does it mean? We never had such a word before. The Torah never talked to us about miksha. We know kasha means hard. What is miksha? So Rashi says, if you look in the Targum Unkelus, Unkelus uses the word negid. Now the negid is, Rashi says, lashon hamshacha. It means that there is a contiguous formation. It kind of, everything flows from one common source. Shemamshech esheivari min ha'eshes, that the different branches of the menorah would be brought forth from the actual ingot or block of gold, lakan lakan, on either side. And that would be achieved by hakoshas hakornis, with the hammering of the small tool. However, Rashi says, indeed, that is what it means. I mean, that's how the menorah should be made. That's how the menorah should be made. However, Rashi says that lashon, the language of miksha, does not mean to draw forth, to flow from. It does not mean contiguous. It doesn't mean one single entity, one block from which details come forth. That's not what it means. He says, if you want to get very technical, and Rashi clearly does want to get technical, we should know that the word miksha comes from makas kornis. It comes from the hammering. Miksha means to hammer out. So it's like people say, I hammered this out. You hammer out the menorah. And it comes from the term of hammering out. And it gives us a French word. Our resident Frenchman is not here today, so I don't know what batidits means, unless somebody speaks French or how to pronounce that. But the bottom line is, it means to hammer out or sculpt out. Kimoy, for example, where do we see the word mikshe? Where do we see the word kosha or hard as in the term hammer? Because you hammer hard, you hammer something down. You're coming down with force, with blunt force. You're hammering away with blunt force. So where do we see this idea that mikshe, which means hard or tough or force, how do we know that that's what means mikshe? So Rashi says we do have one example, only one actually, in the entire Torah, and that is found in the book of Daniel. It says that the knees of Belshazzar, when he saw the proverbial writing on the wall, it says his knees were knocking together. So knees knocking together indicates a certain force, like they were coming together with a force. So therefore, it wasn't hammered. It's not exactly what we're talking about here, but the ideas of knocking together. So nokshon means, comes to the word kosher, which means blunt force. So it doesn't really mean hard. It means to kind of to make contact. This idea of making contact, that's the meaning of mikshe, that's the root source of the word. Nobody disputes what the actual meaning is, how God wanted the menorah to be made. Everybody's in agreement that there was a single block of gold. The question simply is etymology. What does the word mikshe mean? The Torah uses the word mikshe, and this Rashi, as usual.
Would have been another use of the word, but for mikshe, then, like, what would have been preferable?
Unkelus seems to think that mikshe comes from the term contiguous, or sculpted out. Sculpted out of a common source. Rashi clearly doesn't say that. So the menorah should be made. It says, Te ose ha menorah. This is an unusual expression. It should have said ta'asu. It should say you should make. Why does it say te ose? Te ose means it will be made. Rashi says, if you want to get very technical, the word te ose actually means me'eleha. It means from in and of itself. It'll make itself. And that makes no sense. Menorah is very ornate, very detail-oriented, very difficult. How does menorah make itself? What does it mean? So Rashi says, Lefi, this could be understood according to a Midrashic teaching. The Midrashic teaching, which is found in Medrash Tanchuma, tells us, Hoya Moshe Miskasheba. Moshe was having a hard time with this. Va'omar, pardon me, Omar le'akadosh baruch hu, so God says to Moshe, Hashlech esakikor laor, throw that entire ingot into fire, vehi naaseis me'eleha, and the menorah will emerge by itself. So actually, this was a magic menorah. It did happen by itself. It was teyose. God said to Moshe, it will make itself. You will not have to do this. First, he tells him how to do it. And he says, it's going to make itself. It's going to make itself. The menorah is going to come out of itself, out of the flames. Lekach, because that's how it was in the end, and because Moshe Rabbeinu at this point was choking on the job, loy nichtav tase. That's why it doesn't say tase or tasu, rather it says teose, because this indicates that in the end it will be made by itself. Now we go into the details of the actual body of the menorah. The first thing we talk about is yerecha. Yerecha literally means a thigh or a leg. So Rashi says, "Hu haregel shel mata." This refers to the stand, literally the foot on the bottom of the stand. Ha'osui kimenteva, which is made kind of box-like, a large base, a large formation. The shloisha ragloyim yotzen himenu lamata. There were three little legs that this box was standing on the ground. So this is the meaning of yirecha. That's what Rashi says. The Rashbam says it means the shaft. Rashbam says it means the central fulcrum, the main pole in the middle that everything is standing on. Rashi says no. It doesn't mean the branches, that's like a branch. Ultimately, it means the actual stand, which is the bottom part of the menorah. Now, you know, with regard to the menorah, there's a huge amount of controversy because people assume that the menorah that's depicted in Titus's arch, which is the Arc de Triomphe that stated Judea Capta, the Jews are gone, they're vanquished, they're finished. And they used our menorah as a symbol of our destruction. So in that relief, there is a menorah, but it's not our menorah. It's not the menorah of the Jewish people. In fact, there is nothing on that menorah that is accurate. Nothing. It's not the right amount of knobs. It's not the right amount of goblets. It's not the right amount of lamps. There's nothing accurate on it. And most of all, it has round branches. And Rashi is going to clearly say in a moment that the branches of the menorah were angular, as did the Rambam say, as the Rambam's son wrote, my father did not do a hasty sketch with a compass. This is what the menorah looks like, as we're going to see in a moment. So at any rate, the menorah that he depicts has a pentagon on the bottom. Hexagon? I think it's a pentagon. So that's the way people assume that to be, but when the Rambam drew it, he drew actually a round base. So Kamin Kufsa does sound more box-like. That's the truth. And the Rambam drew it more spherical. And it is possible that the Rambam maintained we didn't know what it looked like, and it was easy with a compass to just, you know, draw a quick square instead of drawing a square. Because the Rambam's son maintains that the branches were exact. The Rambam's son says that the konim, that the branches, like wings, nimshachem megufish menorah letzadreish biyosher, they come out of the center of the menorah directly, angular fashion, as my father had drawn. He does not mention anything about the base of the box. At any rate, Rashi says that Yerecha refers to the base. It was a large, heavy base on the bottom. It was not a hollow base because the menorah is not hollow. It's not soldered. It's a large, heavy base. This was the primary deposit of gold. Actually, it was on the bottom. And that stood on three little legs. So this is the way Rashi explains it. Now we talk about Vekona. Vekona is Hakona Ha'emtsoi. The reason that Rashi says Yerecha is the base on the bottom is because Rashi says that Vekona is not Koneha, it's branches, plural, but rather one branch. Which one branch is this referred to? The menorah had six branches, three going in either direction. So what does it mean? What does it mean when it says kono? So therefore Rashi says that refers to hakono haemtzoi, the central shaft, the central fulcrum of the menorah, shalo of it, ha'oila be'emtzo hayareach, which comes up from the middle of the base. So there's a large base on the bottom, and there is a central branch that's coming up. But the menorah, we say, has seven branches. Seven lamps, seven branches. The fact that one branch is in the middle and the other branches come out from either side doesn't mean there aren't seven branches. There are seven branches. And these seven branches are, the central one is called the kono. It's zakuf klapi maila. It is the tallest of the branches. It goes all the way up to the top. Va'olav ner ha'emtzai. Upon it was placed the central lamp. The word ner is translated freely in Hebrew today as candle. It's not what it means in a biblical sense. It's not even what it means in a Mishnah sense. The word ner means in a something which has room for olive oil or fuel that a wick could be placed inside. So that's what we refer to here. And so, ola ner hemtzoi. In the middle, there is this central branch. Osui kemin vazach, which was made like a little bowl, a little repository. Lotzek Hashem and Letecha, to pour oil into it, the Lasseis Hapsila, and to place the wick inside it. If you want to know what these look like, at least in Mishnah times, you can go down to the Royal Ontario Museum. They have hundreds of them on display, or dozens for sure. But over there, they're made of clay. But that's the idea of a nair. Unfortunately, in part of the revision of history, which has become infected the whole world, including the world of academia in Canada, they're labeled Palestinian lamps, which makes no sense because they're from 23 centuries ago, and that was before Hadrian renamed Israel or Judea Philistina. But anyway, that's that. If you want to know what a ner is, that's what a ner is. You can actually see actual nerot, actual. That's what it actually is. Gvieha, gvieha are her goblets. So Rashi says something very interesting. These are like ornamental glass or crystal goblets. Aruchim v'ktzarim. They're very long. They're not. They don't take a lot of. You can't pour a lot into them. V'koydim lahem mindros. They're called. I don't know. It's a French word. V'elu asuya mizav. These were also made of the same gold. Ubeltim. There was a depth. It was like a relief. The yotzim mikol kona v'kona, they stood out of every single branch, kemin shenasata bohem bakosov, as the number of goblets that the scripture will ordain. And Rashi says clearly, lehoyo ba'elo lenoi, they were ornamental only. It did not serve a purpose. And of course, the Rambam draws them facing down. So were they to face up, they actually would serve a purpose. If the lamp would overflow, what would happen? Then the cups would catch the oil as it poured down. So the oil wouldn't end up spilling on the floor. But Rashi says they're ornamental. And Rambam depicts them as facing down, which is actually a subject for another day. Anyway, kaftoreha, their knobs. Rashi says, kimin tapuchim. These were spheres like the agulim, like apple-like spheres, saviv, around. They were boiltim, savivois hakonahem soy. They actually protruded from that central shaft. Kederach sha'oysen lemenoris shalofnei hasorim, as candelabras were made, I guess in Rashi's times, before nobility. The koidim lohem, they were called fimlas. Uminyan shalohem kosuv beparsha. The amount of these knobs is articulated in the parsha. Kama kafteirim beltimeno. How many of these protruding spheres do we have? V'chama cholak ben kafter lekafter. And how much space, smooth space, is there between each one of these spheres or apple-like knobs? Ufracheha, Rashi says, tziyudin asuyim bo kiminyan prachem. They were drawn in a manner of flowers. They were depicted as flowers. The Rambam maintains that the prachim were not simply the notion of a drawing or something, a depiction, but rather he says these were like a, what would you call it? I guess like a disc. But the edges of a disc were like, had like filigree. They were turned up. So with a little bit of imagination, it could look like a flower. Like it looked like a flower. This more like a bowl that was slightly turned up at the edges, which mimicked or imitated the idea of like little petals on the edge. And all of this is mimeno yihyu hakol. Rashi says all these details, everything's got to be miksha, everything's got to be hammered out. It's all got to start. Nothing could be added on. Yotze mitoch hatichas ha'eshes. Everything has to come from the original ingot. Don't make flowers, don't make goblets, don't make knobs, don't add these things in after. They must be part of the menorah from the very beginning.
So why did they say it's hammered out if it created itself?
Because it would have had to be hammered out. And actually, according to one opinion, Moshe throws the ingot of gold into the fire and then he's hammering, but not really know what he was doing. He's like, well, magic
why
hammer.
Why did you say Moshe is struggling with the spitzalo? That's the one that's doing all the handiwork.
This is a really good question. So, because we have all these good questions, we're going to go straight to the Biurim book. And we're going to see how the Rebbe explains, because there are a lot of obvious questions here. Like, so there was a magic menorah that made itself, and Moshe was having a hard time with it, but what is this, the hardest part of the Beis HaMikdash? It's all difficult. It's all detail-oriented. It's all sophisticated. It's all hard. What, like you said, it wasn't even Moshe's job. It's Bezalel's job to figure out. So, what really is going on here? Page Reish Tes, Simen Chaf Aleph, in the Biurim on Parshas Truma, the Rebbe asks the obvious question. Tzaruch Bir, this needs to be better elucidated to us. We need to understand.
What page did you say?
Reish Tes.
Reish Tes.
Harei b'melechas haMishkan hayadvarim rabim merkavim v'kashim lebitzua. In the work of the Mishkan, there were many, many difficult and intricate challenges. It was a very complex thing. And despite the fact that it was very complex, including what we learned about previously, the cherubs and hammering out the cherubs, was also incidentally hammered out from a single ingot and also took tremendous skill. Moshe didn't blanch and say, "What? Really? How do you do that?" Just listen to the instructions, he's recording the instructions. Ultimately, he knows he's going to empower somebody. There's a great nephew of his, a kid named Bezalel, who's going to do all this. He doesn't know yet who the kid is, but in fact, the truth is Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't know yet that somebody else is going to do the work. That's the truth, okay. Right? He so far has been given instructions. He has not been told about Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. Yeah, he hasn't been.
That's right.
But at any rate, Moshe doesn't kind of recoil at any of the details and say, "How did I do that?" Like, you read the Chumash, you know, what to say this morning. You can't figure out what it looks like. Can't figure this out. And I tell you, today they have pictures. It helps. It really helps. When I was a kid going to school, so there was like every school owned one of these Mishkan books. Somebody in Israel had made like a model. It had color pictures, and these were very expensive books. that cost like a few hundred bucks. And every school would buy one. And then when you learn Parshas Truma, they would open the pictures, they would show us the pictures. I mean, today it's nothing. Today it's models and it's done, things done in 3D on the computer. Then, you know, 40 years ago, it wasn't very common to have pictures, and there was this one fellow who, I don't know, made it his lifetime's work. There's a lot of things that are hard to understand, hard to envision. It's challenging, right? And Moshe doesn't say, how do I do that? He just takes the instructions. And yet here, suddenly, Moshe Rabbeinu recoiled and said, what? What? How am I going to do that? And God said, yeah, Moshe, you're right. This is too difficult. Just throw it into the fire. It'll come out by itself. Why the menorah specifically? So here is the Rebbe's answer. The Yesh Leimer. Really and truly, this challenge, this difficulty, this reaction that Moshe Rabbeinu had was not only regarding the menorah. Rather, Elo the Mishkan v'kelev b'chlolusei. Truth be told, this was a general reaction Moshe had. What? I should do how? How do you do that? That was a general reaction that he had. Whatever it was that bothered Moshe, it especially bothered him when it came to the menorah. And listen to what the Rebbe is going to say. What bothered him was not the details of the work, was not the complexities. You know what really bothered Moshe? What bothered Moshe is that tachlis shel haMishkan, the purpose of the Mishkan, at least according to Ramban and Balaturim and others, was kedei l'shamish makoyim l'hashtaras hashchina, a place where God's presence would reside. Now, truth be told, even according to Rambam, who says the main thing is to bring offerings, the Rebbe once explained it's also about Shechina. The question is, what kind and what method do you bring the Shechina? But it's about bringing the Shechina. I mean, the Pasuk says, V'shachanti b'seichem, I'll dwell amongst them. V'yadua, it is known, Sha'ashroa se'olekus, ha'yse b'mishkan, u'be'beis ha'migdash. It is not a secret that God's presence dwelt amongst us in a manifest way in that traveling tabernacle, in the holy Beit HaMikdash, which was in Jerusalem. And it was na'alis la'ein shiur gam mizu hashayra b'elim esalyenim. It was said to be a loftier and more profound manifestation of God's presence, more so even than the angelical celestial worlds. V'al kach tama Moshe. And this exactly was Moshe's stumbling block. This is what he couldn't figure out. He got stuck on this. He said, Ketzad yecholim chumrim gashmim. How is it that material, how is it that gold and silver and copper, how is it that physical things can become a basis, can become a base, if you will, la'ashras hashchina haruchnis, for God's presence, which is entirely spiritual. It's not physical. God doesn't have a corporeal body, or chas v'shalom, a corporeal existence. It's not a physical God. If God's reality is not physical, why would a physical home or a physical sanctuary be the place to house God's presence? And not only any kind of expression of God's presence, the loftiest and the highest, most profound level of God's presence, more so than the celestial worlds even. This is the question. Guess what? The smartest of people had the same question. Shlomo HaMelech. Seven generations later, he also said, "Hein Hashemayim Ushmei Hashemayim Lo Yichal Kalucha." The grandeur of the solar system, of the Milky Way galaxy, this cannot contain God's presence. And this tiny little house, this little speck here on planet Earth, is going to contain God's presence? That makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. That's the truth. It's like I always tell these kids, have these Catholic kids come. I always make the statement to them, I don't believe in God. And they're really happy to hear that, but they're shocked. Like, you don't believe in God? I said, no, I know there's a God. It's not possible to me. I can't fathom that the world is an accident. It's far too complex. Nobody here would accept if I told them, I said that this iPhone exploded itself into existence, that the universe should explode itself, is infinitely more complex than anybody's iPhone. Makes no sense to me whatsoever. It's total gibberish. So I know God created the world. So what do you believe in then? I said, I believe that God cares if I'm nice to you. That doesn't make sense to me. I believe that God cares if we do a mitzvah. God cares that God says, build me a Beis HaMikdash and I'll dwell there. That makes no sense. That's what I have to believe in. So this is exactly Moshe's question. He says, yeah, I know there's a God and I believe that God cares about how people behave. Okay, but he needs a house with gold and silver. he needs a sanctuary. Really, God, that, I mean, like, the sanctuary, you want to say it's for us, okay. A shul is for us. We should have a place to come together. We should be able to worship God. I'll accept that. God needs this? God's presence is going to be manifest in a way that's... What does that mean? That was his question. And this question was found expression specifically with regard to the menorah, about which it is written, quote, Masechet Shabbos, it says, when it talks about Hanukkah, we talk about the menorah, and over there, the Gemara makes the following statement, Edut Leba'ei Olam, this was a testimony to all those who walk the face of the earth, Shehashchina Shel Rabbi Yisrael, that the presence of God dwelt amongst the Jewish people. And of course, in the story of Hanukkah, it was in a very, very real way, right? The menorah that burned for 8 days. That was the sign. But ultimately, the menorah was always the sign. There was always one lamp that was continuously burning, called Ner Tamid. So that one lamp that continuously burned, that was the sign God's presence is always amongst us. And so Moshe Rabbeinu said, the menorah, which is emblematic of the entire temple, this makes no sense. How could that be? How could it be that a menorah is a sign of God? God is in a flame that's fueled by olive oil? It doesn't make sense. Al kach heshiv l'HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's God's response? You're right. Hash lechasekik l'or. Throw the whole lignot into a fire. V'hinases me'eleha. It doesn't happen because of your efforts. It happens by itself. In other words, b'keiches anushim, based on your own efforts, on human achievement, it is impossible to create a dwelling place for God out of physical things. That makes no sense. God is in the realm of the spirit. The physical is in its level affinity, and the twain shall never meet. So how do they meet? Ah, the answer is, this is the koyach in seifi shel habayda. This is the infinite power of the Almighty. This is how we talk about the concept of God being omnipotent. And before God, there is no limitation. And therefore, even a menorah made of physical gold can serve as a way to reflect the Shekhinah. And the Rebbe said, this is not just a philosophical explanation to a medrash that we have difficulty wrapping our heads around, that Rashi invokes to explain the specific scriptural verbiage of tasa made by itself rather than you working hard on it. The Rebbe says, this is actually a very important lesson in our own Avodas Hashem. We are taught that every one of us has the ability to make a mishkan. We can make a dwelling place for God. So one might think that to make a dwelling place for God means to live as a spiritual person. If you live as a spiritual person, if life is a spiritual experience, then you can be connected to God. And God, the spirit of divinity, can rest and reside within you. It can resonate within your actions, within your spirituality. And people can understand that. But what they can't understand is that God should be stuck in physical realities, that the mitzvah has to be performed in a certain way. To say, hug a tree, that I get. Watch the sunset, be amazed, be awed at creation. Look through the Hubble telescope, see the Milky Way galaxy, and be blown away. That's spiritual. That's cool, man. That, I can relate to a Judaism like that. But a Judaism where I have to chew on a cracker, dafke when it's dark at night and I'm going to get indigestion? Really? Why does God care about that? A Shabbos Kodesh where I have to worry about all these details, these niggling details of Shabbos? If I did this or did that or the other thing. Love. It's about love. It's about feeling good. It's about being inspired. It's about being spiritual. It's not about those details. Who needs, what's the difference with this physicality? These material, obsession with material details. It's a good question. It's a good question. Guess what? Moshe Rabbeinu had that question. You're in good company. But now listen to the answer. God's answer is, your job is to ignite the situation, throw it into a fire. In other words, take the gold, take the block, take the physicality, and throw it into the Ur. And you do your activities. You do these mitzvahs, which seem so technical and so camp and pedestrian and mundane. You do them with a sense of spiritual fervor. You do them with a sense of holy passion, the fire of your own neshama. And then it's not your job. It doesn't make sense to you. It's not about your effort. It's not about your achievement. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "V'hu nasa me'aleh." The presence of God, it'll happen in and of itself. It's really not the sum total of its parts. It's not just because you made an effort. Ultimately, the reason that this is meaningful, the reason that it becomes a reflection of God's presence, is because God says so. So you do your part, and God says, "That's what I wanted." Yeah, the physical, the material, the ordinary, the little details, the niggling nuances. That's what I want. And if you do those things, my presence indeed resides in you, and you become a mishkan, you become a menorah, you become a Beis HaMikdash.